Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. Tim, Michael, Mo, and the occasional guest discussing digital analytics issues of the day. Find them on Facebook at facebook.com/analytics hour and their website analyticshour.io. And now, the Digital Analytics Power Hour.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. This is episode 87. You know, we play in digital, but we live in the physical world, a world where understanding behavior has always been important, but is now amplified by the ability to track location based on any number of different methods. But what do we get with all this offline tracking? Well, sit back and relax as you are driving in your car, or is that you sitting at your desk, or wait, over there on your balcony? Oh, we see you. We see you all. Ha 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 ha. Okay, not really. But increasingly, the connection of offline data to online brings some interesting results. One of my co-hosts, located in Columbus, Ohio, is Tim Wilson. Welcome, Tim.
Hey, Michael, let me just reach across the desk and shake your hand.
That's right. And my other co-host, probably sipping a flat white in her white flat in Sydney, Australia, Mo Kiss.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Welcome. I don't know.
One day you will get used to it. One day.
What?
No, that was what I used to miss a beat.
There was no thing there at all. Like it just was, huh? This is a normal.
But actually, yes, I had a delicious flat white this morning.
Yeah. It was, that's great. And I am Michael Helmling. But we need to add someone to the conversation who can help us triangulate, if you will, the intersection of the cool versus creepy and all this location data. So we invited our guest, James Fogelberg. James is the founder of Landmarks ID, a mobile location intelligence company based in Sydney, Australia. Prior to that, he spent many years in the media marketplace and different companies, but most recently as head of innovation at AdShell, where he worked to help understand audience movement and location. Welcome to the show, James.
Kia ora, how are you?
That was a New Zealander welcome. So just to confuse our guests further.
James, are you from New Zealand?
I am. I'm a Kiwi. Hopefully I'm your fifth Kiwi on the show.
Oh, this is great. No, this is really good because most of my references are more New Zealand and not Australian, and I'm afraid to use them because I think I'll offend Australians. But since you're from New Zealand, so this is going to go great.
Yeah, bring it on.
All right. There you go. Well, all right. Well, let's get started with maybe a little bit of background on what you're doing, kind of the work and some of the technology that underlies it, because I think that will help spur the conversation in terms of what's possible and what is happening in the marketplace in terms of these location-based data collection capabilities.
Sure thing. At Landmarks ID, we help brands and marketers learn more about their customers using privacy-compliant mobile location data powered by the smartphones consumers carry with them at all times. And what we do, so we work with brands and we help them understand where their customers move in the real world against nominated points of interest. So basically, we've got two core technology platforms. One is mobile device centric, so it's an SDK that gets integrated into a mobile app. And the second is our mobile location intelligence platform, which sounds like a mouthful, but basically is a network of geofence points of interest. So much like you might create tags on websites and understand people's visits to websites, we've created a micro geofence network of points of interest in the real world. So basically, if a building exists in the real world, we can build a geofence around it and then activate that geofence on behalf of the brand. So what that allows brands to do is understand, again, which of their customers have provided their consent as they enter those locations. It abides by both iOS and Android privacy policies, and we work at the discretion of what the brand wants to accomplish.
Do you want to just give us an example? And maybe let's use The Iconic, right? Because we're 100% online retailer. We live the dream because all of our data is online. So what kind of value would we gain by looking at that offline geo data?
Sure. So I think The Iconic is actually a really good example because I catch public transport to work. I see the Iconic handing out $20 off customer vouchers all over the place. A lot of your shipments probably get shipped to people's work addresses. So do you know where your customers live? So if you look at like your advertising and marketing purposes, where are you spending your money at the moment? And are you targeting people that are existing customers or actual new customers? So like if people get their shipment sent to their CBD work address, do you actually know where they live? So when you do outdoor media campaigns, for example, or handing out promotional flyers, you could target those in the geographical areas on people's early morning commutes, i.e. they're coming from home into the city, and target them appropriately.
So do you want to just take a step back and talk a little bit more? Because obviously I've spoken to James kind of in life a lot about this, but for our listeners, it would might be interesting if you just explain a little bit more about how geofencing works and like what that actually means.
Sure. So geofencing is basically creating a point of reference over a point of interest. So in the most simplistic sense, a geofence is a circle over a real world location. So if you think of a sports stadium as a circle, you could create a circle over the sports stadium. It acts like a virtual tripwire. And as and when a consenting customer enters that location, their device informs the brand owner they're at that location.
What's the mechanics of that? Like, I have to know you're my customer. And then you said the customer has to kind of opt in. They have to have an app with location services enabled. They have to have, what do they have to do in order for them to be detectable as having crossed that virtual tripwire?
Sure. So this kind of gets into the privacy versus non-privacy compliance. So there's a bunch of people who use location data through mobile bid stream. So in programmatic advertising, a publisher who's selling an ad unit puts a piece of advertising up for sale, often attached with a longitude and latitude, and people scrape that data and infer that person's in a location. Now, the people who scrape that data don't have the consent of the customer, whereas when you work with things like a mobile application, for example, like a bank's application. So I have, like everyone has a relationship with a bank. I download my bank's application. I turn that application's location services on because I want the inherent benefits as a customer to turn it on. So for example, I want to find my closest ATM bank branch when I'm at the international airport. I want the bank to know that I'm flying passively in the background so they don't like block my cards from transactions, etc. Because I've provided my consent to that bank or the brand in that case, I'm with Landmark's ID, we build out additional value propositions for that bank to learn more about their customers.
Do they have to have the app open? Do they just have the app running in the background? How does that, what's the threshold? And I guess maybe the broader question is generally what sort of a scale, if I've got 10,000 active users of my app, can I expect to have 500 that I'll be able to use or 9,500 or somewhere in between, or does it totally vary by industry?
Yeah, all great questions. There's probably about 10 minutes of answers there, but at a high level. So you've got two platforms, Android and iOS. So just to go through the permissions or opt-in process. So with Android, you've got permissions. Now, anybody who's listening to this podcast can actually go to the Google Play Store, look up an app that's on your phone. If you're an Android user, or anyone can do it actually publicly, scroll to the bottom of the page of that app and click on permissions. So I don't know, say United Airlines Android application, click on permissions. And at the bottom of that page, you'll see all the permissions that you as an application user grant United Airlines, for argument's sake, when you download that application. And with Android being owned by Google, they're slightly more open to providing those permissions all the time than say Apple. So on the iOS platform run by Apple, location services is a specific opt-in versus with Android, just by downloading an application that's turned on location services, you by default have granted your permission to Android. So with iOS, some of you may be familiar, like take Facebook as the sort of ubiquitous example. You download the Facebook application and it'll ask you to enable location services. And you as a consumer say allow or don't allow. If you click allow, you have granted Facebook the right to access your location. Now, Facebook can choose to always access your location, to select while in use, or if you say don't allow, they put you to never. So this is how the privacy compliance piece of location services works. With always, that app owner has access to your location if they so choose, like it says, always. While in use with iOS, works with either in two capacities, either one, when the app's in the foreground, i.e. you're looking at the application, or whilst the app's in the background, i.e. you haven't hard closed the application, and if it pulls your location in the background, the blue bar will start to appear. So it'll tell you that, using the example before, United Airlines is using your location in the background. Again, it's fully transparent, so the consumer can choose to turn that location setting off in their settings if they so choose.
So you keep referring to United Airlines. Can you explain a little bit about, like, how would this be beneficial to a company like that?
Yeah, sure. So it could be in a couple of different capacities. So they might have a feature within their application that allows you to book flights. So you, instead of you having to enter New York City as your current location to book a flight from, it'll automatically by default know you're in New York City and try to find your flight to wherever you're looking to go. So it speeds up the journey for the customer. There's airlines that we're speaking to that want to understand whether people are through security or through immigration at an airport, so they can start to understand whether someone's likely to miss a flight, and then also provide advised walking times through terminals. So for example, if you're at Heathrow and you've arrived at the terminal and they know that based on previous data, it takes a 40-minute walk to get to the gate, they can tell you your current walking time today from check-in to gate is 40 minutes. Or alternatively, if they know that you're still, I don't know, stuck in duty-free or you haven't gone through security and they're on final call, they can start the process to look for your bag to offload you because you're not going to make it in time.
Wow.
While you're standing in security, they could be reminding you, hey, you're not going to make it. Right. Give it up, buddy.
Or the idea would be
that that family of seven in front of you that is going to take forever, you're going to want to murder them.
or for example, they could remind you 40 minutes before that time was to come that you need to leave now to make your flight on time. Just like Google Maps services provides indications of your meeting time, saying, hey, it's time for you to leave for your meeting because traffic's heavy. Like, airlines want to take off on time. It costs them tens of thousands of dollars if they don't make their gate window. So there's huge business expenses that companies are trying to optimize. And like one sort of latent consumer or customer who's late to a plane or whatever has huge implications for the business.
So the husband and wife who are arguing about when they need to leave for the airport, they could just defer to the app. It could be a marriage saver. I think, wow, that's fantastic.
Or you just do what my fiance does and you just leave and make sure that she gets herself to the gate on time. And then if I make it, it's a miracle.
Do you know, it's really funny, actually. So about a month ago, I was at a conference in the US called CXL Live, and we had Gary Angel was speaking about offline data. So Gary's actually been on the show twice before, and he is a former digital analyst who's now applying a lot of his learnings to how people navigate through a physical store. And one of the discussions that we had kind of after his session was talking about, with a lot of location data, like, people kind of do sometimes think it's a bit creepy, and there's this inherent value for business, but how do you make the customer, how do you actually make it a better experience for the customer so that they want to opt in? And those examples that you're giving is like the first time the penny's actually dropped for me of like, oh shit, yeah, this can make my life easier. It's not just about it being beneficial because the plane leaves on time. It's like, you won't miss your flight, or like, that's actually something I don't think someone's explained to me very well before. So
yeah. There's another great example in the quick service restaurant space. So Domino's, pretty innovative in what they do in terms of being a pizza company, but how they're using technology. So they've got mobile location technology executions where they start to cook your pizza when you arrive in proximity to the store. And they know the speed you're moving at based on whether you're walking, biking, or driving. And so they basically have perimeter geofences set up around their stores. And as you come in proximity to the store, they cook your pizza so that they can basically guesstimate your optimized arrival time so your pizza's fresh.
That's cool.
But it's weird in that all you get asked is, do you want to enable location services? There's not a mechanism when you're getting that prompt to actually tell you this is why you might want to and this is the benefit to you, right?
Sorry, I probably breezed over that. In the latest versions of iOS, the brand owner, i.e. the application owner, is through Apple, is able to provide a sentence or two as to why they're trying to turn on location services for always or while in use. And I can provide some examples. of those.
So do you have a, I know I asked like four questions at once. So do you have a sense, one, I guess between iOS and Android, and now this totally makes sense. And I think I knew that was it's different mechanisms for opting in. One, is there inherently one or the other have a higher general opt-in rate for location tracking? And then two, what is the generally in a, it, I'm sure it varies by brand, by app, by everything, but do more people, are we at a point in 2018 where people are like, yeah, if you're asking for location services, I'll give it to you? Or is it more often to say, oh, hell no?
Yeah, good questions. So I guess as a rule of thumb in Android, if the application owner puts location services, and there's two different accuracies of location services in Android. So there's like approximate and precise, and, you know, broadly speaking, they kind of speak for themselves. But if they put that into their application, by default, 100% of people who download the application have location services consent or permission, using Android's terminology, to Android. In iOS, it does differ, but it really comes down to the value proposition of what the brand or the application owner is doing. So 100%, if you're doing something creepy or untoward or whatever, like if you're Words with Friends and you're asking for location services to be enabled, like there's no inherent value proposition for the customer, right? But if you're a brand and you've got a legitimate value proposition for a customer, it could be that you're offering special deals or promotions. It could be that you're providing relevant content and news or weather. It could be that you're making sure that people get to flights on time, or you optimize the app for what they're doing, like if it's shopping or whatever.
In both cases, can just mobile app tracking actually include in its reporting, in its tracking, whether you've got that, like you had 10,000 active users, and this is of those active users, these were the ones that had this percentage had it?
Yeah. So when you download an application as a consumer, you share a bunch of data sets to the application owner. Okay. There's some that are mandated by the platforms. So like, you know, what location setting consent did the person give? What push notification consent did the person give on iOS? But you also share things like, what's your mobile advertising ID? What's your operating system? What telco are you connected with? What software version of your operating system are you on, etc.? So with that, if you think of a bank that has, for argument's sake, 10 million customers, of those customers, not every single one's going to download an application because some people might not be mobile first or whatever. So they're going to then have a sub-segment of their customers. Let's just say it's, I don't know, 7 million of their customers have downloaded the application, and then a subsegment of those have turned on location services. Like in the banking industry, it's pretty high. It's north of, depending on like the market, but it's normally 80 to 90% of people turn on location services. And so they are able to match that one-to-one to their customer because you download a mobile application. So if I bank with Commonwealth Bank of Australia in Australia, and I log into my application with my customer number. So the bank knows my customer number. I log in, they create that as a safe device or a trusted device for me, and they link the mobile advertising ID of the device, which is a resettable ID. Think of it as like a license plate for your phone. So it's not like your VIN or chassis number that's sort of like stamped into your vehicle. It's a license plate that you could update or reset. So your mobile advertising ID then links the customers, the bank would know the customer number, and then they now know the mobile ad ID of the consumer. And with that, you're able to now link different data sets for the brand. Well, the brand does. Like, so at Landmark's ID, we don't know anything about the personal information of the device. We don't know who owns it or anything like that, or what their banking relationship is with that customer, how much they earn or anything like that. We just provide data to brands, and then they ingest that data and use that for various business purposes.
So is there a marketplace for the data itself in that case?
No, not at all. So we're an enabler for brands. Brands own the data. So if you look at things like GDPR coming in, think of us as like sort of like a bit of an abstract example, but Salesforce helps brands build data sets on their customers from a CRM perspective, right? They don't have a direct relationship with any of those brands' customers. Landmark's ID, we're an enablement pipeline to build location insights for brands, and then we provide the data to the brand. All those data and insights are 100% owned by the brand. It's their relationship with their customer. We don't want anything to do with data ownership or anything to do with any of their own personally identifiable information. It's a one-way data feed. So we feed data into brands.
But in theory, could someone like a bad actor go out and capture this kind of data if they had an app that people were using to then sell off to people? Has that happened? Or is that a risk, I guess, of this space?
Sure. So there are organizations out there that get access to location data through other means, not necessarily through. So when you're talking about mobile app, you're talking about GPS level mm-hmm. data, right? And you've got the capability to potentially, at the discretion of the app owner, get access to that location always. Now, it's at the app owner's discretion. It's their relationship with the brand. There are people out there that use mobile advertising bid stream data to start to build up pictures of where people move. Now, what their motives are is their business's discretion, but there are people out there that want to learn more about where people go, and then they sell your data for advertising purposes, much like online retargeting exists today,
right?
But they use where you go in the real world to understand your behaviors, purchase intents, and brand affinities.
Yeah, or Facebook to understand everything about you always.
Yeah. I think what, so we see ourselves at Landmark's ID as very much like a marketing tech solution. We work for the brands, and it's what they want to do in their relationship with the consumer. There's people out there that scrape things like your MAC address coming off your phone, or that create free Wi-Fi networks. Like, inherently in society, there's always going to be some form of bad actors, regardless of the industry or the purpose. The point for us as our business is we want to help good brands that have great relationships with their customers create new value propositions for where customers spend the majority of their time, which is offline, and where customers spend the majority of their cash, which according to PwC's 92% of transactions take place offline. Yet insights on where people go and their offline behaviors have lagged online. We just want to help brands sort of go along that pathway. And at the same time, I think brands themselves recognize that they don't want, like, you know, you mentioned before, Michael, Facebook, like, brands don't want to continue to pass data through to Facebook. They want to learn more about their customers and create new value propositions for their brands. And likewise, they've licensed software and technologies, and hopefully more so Landmark's idea along the way, to be like part of that process and learn more about their customers.
I'm going to take us off a cliff. I love doing this, where I just take us down. Like, we're having this great discussion. I'm like, oh, let's go over here. There's something shiny. So talking about geodata, there's obviously lots of different mechanisms, like beacons and connecting to Wi-Fi networks mm-hmm. and all sorts of stuff. And obviously using the mobile device is the most accurate. But are there potential flags for businesses in the fact that, I mean, the type of customers, and I know this from my own analysis at The Iconic, the type of customers who have our apps are our super engaged. They're our loyal customers. They spend the most. They come back regularly. So I'm just thinking about coming at it from an analyst perspective. If you're using this data to understand your customers, but only your most loyal and engaged customers actually have your app, are you potentially going to have some kind of blind spot on
sample bias, basically, right?
Yeah. So I think, and just for everybody's benefit who's listening, like, I'm not a data expert or an analyst or anything like that. I'm from the media world.
That's okay. Neither are we.
But like, Mo, using your example, I think The Iconic and, you know, the example of people who download the application being super users or whatever, it does depend brand to brand. So, for example, like, a sports betting application is kind of ubiquitous across a lot of the sports betting takes place only online or on mobile. Or if you're a bank or an airline or whatever, the people who download your application is fairly ubiquitous. So it's use case by use case. But yes, you're right. Like, the brand knows that themselves. Like, you just gave the example of, you know, that your app owners are your super users. The point is that there's data sets that are available through mobile that are being untapped that can be used to understand more about your customers. You just need to unlock them.
Well, but there are two separate aspects. One, you're saying you've got this data and you can operationalize it to improve or enhance the customer experience, or even, and hopefully drive more benefit for the brand, just in absolute terms of touch points and offers and interactions you can have. And then there's the second, which is, okay, using it for getting a deeper understanding of the customer, just you need to go in with your eyes wide open. Like that's using it for analysis and having that recognition, right? So it seems like they're really sort of two different uses of the data. And it may be that you're like, hey, we can totally make a great customer experience mostly for our most loyal customers, but that's fine. They're your most loyal customers. And that's kind of a, if you have enough volume, that totally makes sense. And from the analysis, I think, Mo, to your question, it sounds like, James, you're saying, yeah, you know, yeah, don't think that you've got necessarily a representative sample of your customer base, but it's still potentially valuable.
Of course.
Right.
So a great example would be like if you take a geofence over a McDonald's store, like we're not going to be able to tell you every single customer that turns up to a McDonald's store, but we'll be able to give you a really good insight as to the time of day they turn up, where else they go, how many of them turn up to Burger King or Hungry Jack's in Australia, etc. Like that's data that is available on your customers that you may not be capturing.
That was a fantastic on-the-fly localization of your message. I remember being very confused by Hungry Jack when I was in Australia. I'm like, that logo and the menu looks exactly like Burger King.
Yeah, the Whopper exists in Australia.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing is like if, you know, like you look at like traditional market research surveys and panels, like this is data on directly matched to your customers, one-to-one, you're able to use those insights to inform a bunch of different like strategic business opportunities. So for example, just talking quick service restaurants, we're talking to a company locally that's looking at where they should build their next restaurant based on where their customers are. So that's a multi-million dollar exercise. They've got to buy the land, build the restaurant, find a franchisee. So where should they build their next restaurant? They've got over several million mobile applications downloaded by their customers. So at an aggregate level, heat mapping where their customers are by time of day and day of week and analyzing that against like restaurant, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner, etc., and understanding where to build their next restaurant. Or using the airline example of where the airline customers fly, that's not going to be 100% of those airline customers being located at Buenos Aires Airport. But if you now know that 300,000 of your customers go to Buenos Aires Airport every year and you don't fly there, that's, you know, substantiated empirical data that you should start looking at putting an airline there or flying your plane there, sorry.
I keep being really selfish and thinking about this from my own perspective and how I would manage this, like having this data set coming in as one of my points. What about when we talk about stitching? Because we all know I love talking about user stitching. The context of like a mobile IDFA works really well. And I'm really lucky because we collect that using Snowplow Analytics. But I'm just thinking about, because people always, because I talk about user stitching.
Time out, a mobile. What's the
IDFA, which is the thing that Fogelberg spent like 5 minutes explaining earlier.
So it's your mobile advertising.
That's ID. Your advertising ID. Okay. Yeah. He said the mobile advertising. Okay.
Okay. Okay. Fine.
Okay. Don't interrupt Mo, but that's for iOS.
Yes.
For Android,
yes.
It's your AAID.
Yes.
So they're linked to each platform.
That's the one that's the license plate for your phone?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anybody out there who wants to understand what their mobile advertising ID is, you can download an app called The Identifiers. Literally just go to Google Play or App Store, download The Identifiers, and it will show you your 36-digit character, which is your mobile advertising ID. It's a sequence of numbers and letters that's unique to your device. However, it's consistent across every single application.
Yeah, and you can reset them as well.
Correct. However, it's incredibly more robust than a cookie, and every single time you re-download your application. So if you upgrade from an iPhone 6 to 7 and you download the latest version of, let's just use the example we were talking about before, the banking application, you've then shared your new mobile advertising ID with that bank application, and then you log into that bank application with your customer number, that bank now knows your latest mobile advertising ID.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about, so one of the questions that I always get asked is, when it comes to user stitching, how do you stitch users if they're not logged in? And I'm just really curious from your experience as you start talking to different brands. And I always say to people, I'm like, look, I'm really lucky because we have Snowplow, I can get their mobile IDFA, which as far as I know, you can't store on the Google stack. And also secondly, I'm even more lucky because we make all of our users log in order to transact. So for me, it's actually a lot easier to go back and stitch users. But I'm thinking about the context of, like, if you are in a company where people don't log in, like, I don't know, can you think of any other ways that people could potentially stitch this data back to online behavior? I'm just thinking out loud.
Okay, so for the non-analyst on this podcast, user stitching is connecting data sets.
It's basically using identifiers like their customer ID, their mobile IDFA, their email address, yep. and then trying to link back to different online visits that they had so that you count them as one visitor instead of 10. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Yeah. So the example you're giving is that there's a mobile application that doesn't have a login yeah. process.
I mean, is that common or like do most companies make?
Well, a good example would be maybe like a newspaper or a news publication that doesn't have a paywall.
Yeah.
So in that case, they don't necessarily need to know who you are. They just look at like your offline activities, i.e. they visit a car yard, you're now a car intender, and the advertising that you see is Toyota, Hyundai, Mazda, etc. For you, in the iconic sense, you're wanting to understand, you know, maybe where someone goes in the real world and then do they transact. So if I guess it's somewhat case by case dependent on the brand or application owner. Like if they've built into their application no means to link, you know, one customer connection point, i.e. a mobile app with a website, then it's difficult to do that. However, like you could potentially have a collaboration between multiple brands where they might understand, you know, let's just say you've got two non-competing brands, an airline and a quick service restaurant, and both have a relationship with the customer, i.e. the same mobile advertising ID, and the airline knows the person's email address and the quick service restaurant doesn't. If those two brands, for argument's sake, wanted to collaborate, then they could share data based on their own privacy policies and consents with the customer. There could be something there, but that's getting quite down a rabbit hole and of likelihoods.
We're very good at going down rabbit holes, aren't we?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'd put it back on brand owners or people working for brands that don't have connection points between, like if you've got, I don't know, a person's physical address and you're not linking that in any way to their online activity and you're not linking that in any way to what mobile connection points you've got with them, then of course it's going to be difficult to like pull those together or stitch them, using your words.
Yep.
So we've been talking a lot about the app, but I think in kind of some of our prep, you were sort of noting like, what if it's mobile web? It sounds like app, once they enable location services, you're in good shape and you have good data and it's reliable. What are kind of the other?
Sure. So just really quickly, just to wrap up on that mobile app piece. So there are brands out there that do things that are not privacy compliant through app. So for example, if you're inferring someone's location based on the Wi-Fi they're connected to, so certain companies that drive around the streets sniffing Wi-Fi addresses and tracking the fact that it's like Bob's free Wi-Fi, they know the longitude and latitude of where Bob's free Wi-Fi is. So if you're in an application and you're connected to Bob's free Wi-Fi, they can infer your location. So with mobile applications, the privacy consent is, if it's done through the platforms like iOS and Android and the customer opts in, then you're compliant. But if you're doing something untoward, then there are workarounds. So just to be really clear on that. In terms of answering the second part, you've got a raft of different ways of or other sources of location data. So like with mobile web, you're getting sort of suburb level accuracy. When you're doing Wi-Fi sniffing or scraping mobile devices walking into an area, common in like where there's free Wi-Fi networks, so you're wanting to understand like footfall analytics, retail shopping malls do a lot of it. So they deploy quote unquote, you know, shopping mall free Wi-Fi, and then they scrape the MAC address of your device and where it moves. So your only way as a consumer to stop that happening, let's just assume you see the small sign that they place by the door saying that they're doing it, is to turn your Wi-Fi off when you walk into one of these areas. So that involves basically going in and turning off the capability where your phone automatically connects to a known Wi-Fi network. Your mobile device has what's called a MAC address. Good news for those Apple owners listening, your MAC address automatically rotates. So it's changing all the time. With that, they start to understand numbers of devices moving to certain areas, and then a shopping mall might start to, for example, charge a tenant more rent for an area where more footfall goes than an area where there's less footfall.
Huh. So how accurate is that?
MAC address?
Oh, scraping. With the connecting to Wi-Fis, Wi-Fi networks?
Sure.
I mean, like, could you tell where someone is in a store or more like in a mall?
Yeah.
Depends on their routers, right?
Yeah. Depends on what they've set it to.
Okay.
But like, you can pretty much know which aisle of a supermarket they go down, how long they dwell in that area. So depending on the mobile device and the operating system that you're on, generally every 8 to 20 seconds, your device is trying to find a known network. So it's basically sending out a ping, right? It's saying, is there anything out there? And if it sees a known Wi-Fi network, like Mo's and Jamie's Wi-Fi network, it connects. So they hook up. So if you're spending time in that area, like depending on your device, every 8 to 20 seconds, it's counting your dwell time. So you can start to heat map audience movements. So you might see if you're a supermarket that people spend a lot longer dwelling in the pharmacy or cosmetics and healthcare aisle than the chips and confectionery.
Interestingly, for listeners who are interested in learning more about that, I'm pretty sure Gary Angel covers that sort of thing. If they come to Marketing Evolution Experience, they can choose not to attend our recording in front of a live audience and instead attend Gary's session that we somehow got stuck head-to-head with, where I'm sure he will address that mobile tracking option. I'm not bitter. Hashtag, yes, I am.
Having seen him present and trying to spur less people to come to our session, it was actually really interesting talking about applying exactly this to shopping malls and the like, and about like your staffing levels and all that sort of stuff. So
it's possible that he appeared on a podcast called the Digital Analytics Power Hour and sort of talked about some of this stuff as well. So I hear.
But we're clearly saying, please do not come to our session. Go to Gary's. I think that's the clear message.
Is this like voting where you tell people not to turn up and then they actually don't and you get really upset when you lose the election?
Oh, no.
I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there.
Will you be upset, Mo? All right, let's get back to our regularly scheduled podcast.
Episode number 64, Analog In-Store Analytics with Gary Angel.
So just on the MAC address piece. So the interesting piece about that is from GDPR perspective, you can't tell. So when I say you, as the retail store owner who's deployed this technology, or the shopping mall owner, or the airport, train station network, whatever it might be, you can't tell if a MAC address is linked to a UK or EU citizen's phone.
Oh.
So suddenly you would be storing MAC address data based on potentially any tourist, let's just use Sydney, any UK or EU tourist who comes through one of your areas, you're suddenly collecting data without their consent.
Ooh.
Ooh, interesting. That's scary.
Well, that'll be interesting to work out, because there's no way for you to even delete that data if they ask you to, because you have no idea who they are with just a MAC address.
Well, and on iOS, the MAC address is constantly rotating.
Wait, but couldn't you argue that if a MAC address is rotating so frequently, you couldn't actually tie it back to a user, and therefore it's like it wouldn't meet? I feel like someone was talking about this recently, but I really should stop talking about GDPR because I am do not know my shit. But if you can't tie it back to a user because it rotates so heavily, then it wouldn't be considered personal information.
So I guess, first of all, the GDPR policies are still, at least from the advertising and media industry perspective, are still being ironed out, and we'll have to sort of wait post their sort of go live date to see how that plays out. But you could argue that as one stance, Mo. Mm. You could argue that it's come from a consumer's device that they didn't provide their consent in any capacity. So which side of that do you sit on? And then you've got Android, which is the majority of mobile users, both in Australia at 65% roughly, and then globally, who don't rotate their MAC address.
How long has Apple been, because it used to be MAC address was kind of the immutable link to the hardware, and I'm assuming they started rotating it specifically because it was such an easy kind of permanent cookie, but I completely missed that they were rotating it now. Is that like for the last 5 years? How out of touch am I is the question.
No, it's definitely not the last 5 years. I would say it's the last ballpark 12 to 18 months.
Yeah.
It was one of the platform updates. It might have been iOS 8 or 9. I can check and give it to you for the show notes.
Yeah, that's okay. I missed that. That's interesting.
Okay. If we're talking about this, isn't all of like this whole industry about better leveraging location data somewhat dependent on the Apples and the Googles and all that sort of stuff? Like, I mean, ultimately, what happens, because I'm thinking about the context of like the mobile IDFA, suddenly it's like a MAC address and they start regenerating them, or they decide to not have them at all. Or, I mean, I don't know, isn't that kind of scary that so much could be built on companies who, if they change their policies?
Are you constantly chasing that they're going to keep, as privacy concerns go up, they'll keep trying to, like the rotating MAC address was a way to foil somewhat some level of tracking. And are you playing a constant game chasing, trying to keep working around whatever they're putting in place?
Sure. Yeah, good question. So I guess like there's lots of businesses and industries out there built on platforms or reliant on contingencies of others. In the case of the mobile advertising ID, it was created because previously people were using the UDID, which is the unique device ID. That's more like your chassis number in your phone. So basically they created the advertising ID for, as it says, advertising purposes. Like, interestingly, Apple themselves, you know, they play a high privacy sort of moral standards and things like that, but they themselves use location data for their own advertising businesses. So there's a platform called Apple Ads. So, and just to quote them, they say device location. If the location-based Apple Ads system service is enabled, then your location may be used to serve you geographically relevant ads. Your device location is not stored by Apple's advertising platform and profiles are not constructed from this information.
Right.
However, they're using that to sell advertising within, say, Apple News or whatever.
So basically the whole world's corrupt.
I wouldn't say that. I'd just say that people are using that location data for commercial purposes.
I know. I feel like we've just been talking about privacy and GDPR so much. And I do like that we talked a bit about the customer perspective and how you can add value. But yeah, there's a bit of me that's like, everyone's doing it.
And I think the interesting thing is, like, by default, every Apple phone has that enabled and turned on. So, like, I can give you in the show notes every listener can see if you've got an iPhone where you've been recently. So you can actually see what Apple's tracking of your location, and you can choose to opt out if you want.
You're going to single-handedly drive that Android adoption in Australia from 65% to 75%.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I mean, that's Android's owned by Google, so like they've got their own commercial purposes as well. So I think the interesting thing though is like, it comes down to, as a consumer, I think you either sit of one of two pathways, right? One is if it makes my life easier and it creates value out of for me, then I'm in for it. If it's creepy and it's doing something that I'm not comfortable with, then you can opt out. It's kind of like, I don't know, at least from my perspective, I kind of see this two unique camps, and you either sit in one of the great thing is you can choose that at a brand to brand level. So you don't have to sit there saying, I'm either in or out for everything. You can say, I'm going to do it for Uber because there's a value creation there, but I'm not going to do it for brand XYZ because I can't see the value. Consumers have the freedom to be able to do what they want on a one-to-one level with each individual brand, consumer to consumer.
What about in context like what's happening with WeChat right now, where they're actually bringing apps into their app? Have you explored that or dealt with that at all?
Creating like the Chinese mega apps?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So do those just share the device location permissions of the app they live within, or?
Good question. I'm not 100% certain or knowledgeable on the Chinese market or how their platforms operate. My assumption would be that there would be some level of data granted to the sub apps that sit within the master apps. They're essentially almost platforms themselves, like the WeChats, the Tencent, etc., almost like the App Store or Google Play, right? So if you look at the idea that, let's just say, they're trying to move towards being an App Store or Google Play, then the master platform, i.e. Google Play or App Store, gets access to those data points and consents. So, and then they pass that on to the individual app owners. So if you sit housed within, you know, WeChat, for argument's sakes, then my assumption would probably be that the people that those individual service offerings will get access to their data, but it probably would be warranting further investigation.
Yeah, sorry, kind of a rabbit trail, but kind of interesting at the same time, because
that's all right.
It seems like that's probably the way a lot of these large companies who have sort of big user platforms will try to go, because it frees them from the platform owners a little bit, or from the device owners.
Well, I think in general, in data, I'm a big believer that brands themselves will start to collaborate with non-competing brands and share not in a creepy capacity whatsoever, but start to share insights on like who the customer is. And I believe from a location perspective, there's two ways that you can identify that. That's either A, through a common mobile advertising ID. So, you know, you download an airline app and a quick service restaurant app, you share the same mobile ad ID, or vice versa, one person's mobile ad ID turns up at another person's physical location. So therefore, by default, those two brands have a crossover with that customer. So I think what we'll see moving forward is more and more brands that are non-competitors start to collaborate from a data perspective and not rely on the Googles and Facebooks of the world.
And then putting on my sort of philosophical cap for a minute, this reminds me a lot of how data collection started on the web, which was, you know, the device cookie was never intended to be used really as a tracking mechanism or an identification beyond just helping to know, you know, whether you'd been to that site before or not based on the data stored in the cookie. And then over time, all of us, people who are interested in knowing more, we grabbed onto those things and started building tracking capabilities on top of them. I just wonder if maybe like technologically, a lot of times we put a technology in place without thinking through how the measurement piece or the tracking piece will interact. And I wonder what it might look like if we were able to kind of develop that simultaneously to create kind of a mutually shared platform or technology. I mean,
you're adorable.
Well, no,
you and your little.
Hey, listen. I just read an article. It's not even my last call, but like they're starting to develop the little headset that reads your mind, right? So like that's the obvious next step past the phone, right? So we had computers. Now we're going to have phones. And eventually we have little earpieces that are reading our thoughts. Maybe before we start giving up all of our thoughts for data collection, we think about measurement beforehand. Certainly, I don't want Google knowing everything, I think.
I stand by my "you're adorable" comment.
Well, be that as it may, I'm just I want.
Do you not want Google knowing all your information if it makes your life easier, better, more enjoyable, efficient, happier?
I already give Amazon and Google a lot of information for that purpose. But as we progress, and again, like I'm creating a future frontier because I honestly, I don't know what's going to be next after the phone. But that's what I mean is it seems like all of the tracking follows the technology and gets creepy real fast because we're doing things that frankly are hacks in a certain sense around the technology to create the measurement tools that we want to keep to create the commerce and even the value. Right? It wasn't built necessarily to do that. It's all coming in behind those kinds of the development of the technology itself. Somebody someday was like, hey, we can go gather the MAC address or the Wi-Fi or something of all of these phones as they pass by us with this beacon, you know, and then off to the races we go. But that wasn't a starting point. Like, hey, as we design Android or as we design iOS, let's create a method so that we can connect people in real time to physical locations.
I think that's an interesting observation. And like, if you look at like the human psyche and the competitive nature of like who we are as humans against one another, like whether you're a human being or a business, you're trying to outdo one another. So like if you compare, say, the analogy of like people finding a data set or a methodology to create new value versus trying to build something like, hey, like I look at like beacon technology, for example, like I look at that going, that's widely overhyped. People basically tried to create a technology without a value proposition attached to it. And now they're trying to segment beacons in and create a value proposition back to it. But they created the hardware first without looking at what the value proposition to the customer is.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly an interesting set of challenges and very interesting conversation. One in which, unfortunately, we're going to start to wrap up because that is what we do. Mm-hmm. We get into a really great discussion and then we end the show as quickly as possible because Tim Wilson's on a tight schedule. No, I'm just kidding. It's not Tim's fault.
I feel like this discussion was really one where James and I could have benefited from having a drink with us.
Yeah. Again, that's where I'm coming to everybody saying, hey, let's get rid of this irrational stigma against morning drinking in Australia.
Making a thing.
I'll happily accept gifts of gin coming from America. any boutique gin distilleries, I'll happily accept gin gifts and continue the conversation.
They don't have juniper bushes.
We make much better gin in Australia, let's be honest.
Oh, I just like trying new batches.
Really? Is it a highlight? Like gin as a beverage is well done over there?
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. When you guys decide to come record a show in Australia, I have got all the Australian gins for you to try on my bar.
It's like you know that I'm not in Australia. Are you tracking my phone?
That's right. Are you tracking his phone? All right. One thing we like to track on this show as we wrap up is something we call a last call. That's where we go around the horn, talk about something we found interesting that could be at any location. But since you're our guest, James, do you want to go first?
Sure. So you kind of dropped me in it, but I think given the subject matter, I think an interesting concept will be in the future, will people create their own, let's just call it data banks, where they provide their data and they license it to brands. I don't think it'll be, or even other consumers, I don't think it'll necessarily be from a revenue perspective, but it's more the idea that like consumers themselves can own the data that's on them and they provide access rights to brands and then they can remove a brand as quickly as they add one. So, you know, instead of Facebook owning all the data on the customers, what if the customers created their own data bank on themselves and gave certain rights and permissions to brands?
That's so scary.
Scary.
Yeah, I'm a bit scared. I'm normally good
but
with
you
change.
As the consumer, but you as the consumer would have the control.
I know.
It's interesting. I actually, the very first Accelerate in San Francisco years ago, my little 5 minute or 10 minute thing, little thing was kind of around that. What if it totally got spun on its head and kind of reimagined as opt-in, trust, total tracking? How might that work? Mm. So, and a couple of people came up, they're like, are you working on that? And I'm like, oh, hell no. Like the assignment was to just like, you know, pie in the sky dream of the future.
Well, some of it is already opt-in. Anyways, we're at last call, Tim. Mo, you ready?
I've been flying about recently, and one of the Australian Airlines, Qantas, has actually put a whole bunch of the LinkedIn Learning sessions on their like video service when you're flying, which has been really good. And one question that I often get asked when I start talking about women in analytics is how men can better support women. So I was watching a video not long ago by Stacey Gordon on the LinkedIn Learning thing about unconscious bias. And I really recommend going and checking it out because I think unconscious bias is one of those things that we probably talk about but don't necessarily completely understand. And Stacey was very good at giving like an idiot's guide to unconscious bias. So I recommend people go check that out.
Nice. Michael, you want to not go last just for giggles?
Yeah, I would love to. So recently I was brought back to this, which is something we've actually talked about on the show before. In fact, we actually even did an episode about it, but I doubt they'll ever let me do this again, which is the CMO survey. And I'm a huge fan of this survey. And the February results recently came out for 2018. And actually, apropos to our topic, there's a whole section on mobile marketing. So they ask this is done by the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University, and they talk to CMOs about all these different marketing topics. So it's always a good read to get a perspective of sort of where, you know, senior leadership and the marketing organizations around the world or in the U.S. anyway are thinking. So check that out at thecmosurvey.org.
Nice. So my last call will be to keep him the most referenced individual ever in the history of the show is going to be a Matt Gershoff. A few weeks ago, he wrote a post, and I know he was working on it for a while, and it was inspired by a discussion with Ellie Feit, past guest, and Kelly Wortham, past guest, and he was kind of making a point that the post is do no harm or A/B testing without p-values. And as most things with Matt, it requires a couple of readings, but basically he's actually positing that if you think about what you're trying to get out of your test, and he says, look, you're either trying to do a do no harm test or a go for it test. And if you're really clear on that if you're doing a go for it test, you don't necessarily need to worry about p-values. Just take the one that has the better results and run with it. And I think like as I'm on my little data science journey, it's one of those that actually has some really pretty profound ideas, which is just not how we think about A/B testing in the digital optimization world. And yet it seems like a pretty powerful thought that kind of has broader ramifications about how we think about when we're doing testing. So a hearty endorsement of that post.
Nice. Awesome. Okay. You've probably been listening to this, and you've probably been listening to it on your phone. And some of you, I already know, have been listening to it at 1.5 speed. But
at McDonald's.
McDonald's, geofenced by, anyways, but if you.
En route to the airport for United Airlines.
And you now have only 15 minutes left before your boarding starts. So make sure you're TSA pre, at least in these upcoming geographies, which we'll insert in post production. Okay. No, you may have comments or questions, and we would love to hear from you. The best way to do that is through either our Facebook page or our website or on the Measure Slack. And James, are you active in the realm of social media? Could people reach out to you on Twitter if they wanted to learn more?
Yeah, sure. Just at James Fogelberg.
At James
Fogelberg, F-O-G.
I'll tweet something. I'll tweet it. Yeah.
It will be tweeted, and we'll make sure it's in the show notes as well. But we want to give people an avenue to reach out as well. A lot of valuable information.
Sure. More than happy to have the conversation.
Yeah. Thank you, James, for sharing some of that with us today and our listeners. And as always, for my two co-hosts, Tim Wilson, Mo Kiss, you're out there. We know you are. We know exactly where you are. But we also want you to keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to join the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, or Measure Slack group. We welcome your comments and questions. Visit us on the web at analyticshour.io, facebook.com/analyticshour, or at analyticshour on Twitter.
So smart guys wanted to fit in, so they made up a term called analytics. Analytics don't work.
Completely spaced out.
Are we pausing for you to start there, Michael?
I'm like, elves are waiting on you.
I don't know if you're familiar, but actually, you could kick it off.
Yeah. No, I'm going to have James kick us off today. It's sort of a whole role reversal thing. Okay, let's go. In
five. Excellent.
What? No. No, come on. Let's do it all pre-show, and then we can take us all outtakes. And then the joke will be on everybody else because the show will be like 15 minutes long and the outtakes will be 45 minutes.
Excellent. So, Helbs, I have a very wide social circle full of interesting people from various industries.
Perfectly okay. I'm just observing.
Excellent. Yeah, so I'm just going to like bring that up in some weird way at some point. Just FYI.
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay. Yeah. Excellent. And I actually didn't even feel like a drink, but and Jamie's like, maybe don't have one. I'm like, no, it's the principle of it. This is the only episode where I get to drink, so.
That doesn't sound like Jamie discouraging you from drinking.
Yeah,
this is a thing that I think you guys can help with, which is let's get rid of the stigma of morning drinking.
Occasionally I listen to your advice.
Sorry, go ahead.
I've been flying. Oh, jeez.
So, my last call will be.
Hey, Tim, what's your last call?
Yeah, nicely done.
Excellent.
Rock flag and geofencing.